Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chappadini with the Go See Talk podcast. Thanks for going back to the show. Man, we are super excited and thrilled to speak to our next guest, production designer, art director, set director extraordinaire, Paul Cripps, all the way from the U and the K. He puts beautiful things in front of the camera so that the camera can capture it and will make you wish that you were transported to that place, whether it is a football stadium, whether it is a crime scene, whether it is a skybox. Paul is the man who makes the magic. So, Paul, we're thrilled to have you here. How's things in your world?
Yeah, it's good. Good. It's a bit cold here. It's coming into winter at the moment in the UK. But apart from that, yeah, all good.
Fantastic. Well, you know, the thing that keeps us warm is laughter and charm and the heart. And, you know, I can tell that the work you do comes through the screen, literally comes through the screen. It's vibrant. It's colorful. You might be able to credit the DP with the colorization and stuff like that, but I think it's got to be your baby, your brain. But let's go back to the very beginning. Did you have a set of crayons that you played with? Were you drawing floor plans? Did you have sections of stairwells? What got you into production design?
Well, I guess I have an artistic background in that my mum is an artist. She's a commercial artist, so she used to draw fashion drawings for newspapers and magazines, and she worked on in-house magazines for people like MG Cars back in the kind of 50s and stuff. So, and my dad ran a printing company, so there's quite a bit of artistic stuff in our family, but not majorly, and definitely not film and TV. But I come from a small town near Oxford called Woodstock. And Woodstock has quite a well-known stately home called Blenheim Palace, which is actually where Winston Churchill was born. It's the family home of the Churchill family. And it's used for a lot of films. And so while I was living there, we had Mel Brooks come and shoot A History of the World Part One. If you remember that film, they did all the French Revolution scenes there. Actually, if you go and see the new Napoleon film, or you see it on Apple, a lot of the scenes of the French Revolution and some of the battles are shot at Blenheim Palace. So it's this big, beautiful kind of building. And in 1978, kind of a year after Star Wars came out, I was nuts about Star Wars. I was about 11, 12 when it came out, and actually maybe a bit younger. But I went to see it about 8 or 9 times, queued around the block to see it. And then literally a year later in 78, Harrison Ford came to make a film in my town, which was a World War II film called Hanover Street. I've told this story many times, but it is one of the abiding memories of my childhood was kind of bunking off school to watch the filming. And our whole town was turned into a kind of Nazi-occupied French town. So we had swastikas hanging off the town hall, which confused visitors getting off the tourist buses to come and see Winston Churchill's grave. And then my grandmother's flower shop, florist's shop, was turned into a French boulangerie, and people would come in and ask for bread, which really confused them when they got inside. And so that really got my interest, you know, picking up bullets after chases around with the kind of motorbikes and sidecars, and seeing Harrison Ford and getting to meet him and Christopher Plummer and getting him to sign my Star Wars poster, which you can see in the back there. You know, that was in the back of my mind, but I actually wanted to be a pilot when I was a kid. I wanted to fly kind of fighter jets, kind of Top Gun kind of thing. But when I actually went, when I was kind of 17, I was too tall, which was really sad. So I kind of didn't, both me and my sister both wanted to work in film and TV, and she wants to work in theater as well. So we didn't really know how to do that. But eventually she went and did theatre design, and I kind of followed her as well. And we both ended up working in film and TV. She works in costume design, and she works for Janti Yates, who works for Ridley Scott, and she works for a number of other big designers, and she's worked on like three Oscar winning kind of costume teams. And I went the other way, and I did set design. So that's kind of how I got into it, in that I was kind of captured by it when I was a kid, and seeing the behind the scenes bit of it rather than, I mean, I used to watch too much television and films as a child anyway. I was constantly being told to go outside, you know, by my mum and dad, because I was always in front of the telly. But that's kind of how I got into it.
Man, that's fascinating. I mean, from Woodstock to the Star Wars posters, I was going to say, you, instead of Luke Skywalker, you're probably hooked by Rick Carter. But then again, you meet Harrison Ford a couple of years later. It's like you're seeing behind the camera, in front of the camera.
I chatted with a number of the crew on the film. Like, the prop master on that film was George Ball, a kind of famous English prop master, and he'd done Superman, you know. And talking to him, you know, it was just fascinating. Just, you know, even though I was a kid and asking probably really dumb questions, but, you know, it was so good. And I think, and seeing a number of films come, that I think that's why it kind of really always interested me.
Well, coming from a creative and artistic background, were your parents supportive in this endeavor? Did they want you to, you know, follow their lead, a different lead, maybe something completely different? How were they feeling about this?
Well, my mum definitely was. I think she, my grandfather was quite artistic, but never had a chance to go to art school or do any kind of art-based career. So she always said he would have loved the fact that we all went into kind of, well, two of three children went into kind of art-based careers. But my mum was supportive. I think my dad was a bit worried about it. I think he thought, you know, you need a proper job as a backup, that kind of thinking. But he was obviously very pleased when I started to make money and make a career out of it. But I think he was always quite proud of me for doing it. But I think he was, at the back of his mind, very worried about the career paths we'd all chosen, because he just didn't come from that world. And he didn't think whether it was, you know, a proper job that you could earn a living from.
Well, I'm trying to put myself in that 11-year-old state where I grew up watching Back to the Future and Tim Burton's Batman and being captivated with, you know, to me, there was a very thin layer. I couldn't really tell what was real, what wasn't. And so having that exposure to the movie being filmed in your hometown and getting to like see behind the curtain at that age, did that change the way you looked at it? Did it inspire you? I mean, like, I'm sure it did, but like, how did that push you even further?
I think it's fascinating. And I think you're right. That's what I learned early on. I saw that, you know, some of the sets, it was plain wood behind, you know, with kind of other bits of wood just to hold it up. You know, it was so flimsy and so, but when you got around the other side, it just looked so real. And there's something a little bit about being a magician. The idea that, you know, there's a secret there. In Britain, I don't know if you have it in the States, but we have something called the Magic Circle, which is what magicians belong to in the UK. And there's a kind of rule where you don't reveal how your tricks are done. And if you do, you kind of get kicked out of the magic circle. And it kind of felt a bit like that you saw exactly behind the curtain and you understood. And that's something that's really fascinated me all the way through my career, is how much you can fool people and get away with, but they still believe it. And not only just on film or on television, but also in real life. I remember I worked on 24 Hour Party People. I don't know if you've ever seen that film. It's a film about the Manchester music scene. And part of it is set in an iconic club in Manchester, which is called the Hacienda. And when we got to Manchester to film it, unfortunately, they pulled the Hacienda down about 6 months before to make it into flats. So we had to rebuild the club, basically from a very small plan we found in a book and some photographs, and we rebuilt it in another warehouse in the north of Manchester. But what the film production did was they got in touch with the DJs who'd originally DJed them, and they still had a list of people who'd come to the nights they run in the 90s or the late 80s 90s. So they emailed all these people, and they all came back to the hacienda. So we'd recreated it. And I remember on the night they did a club night, because we invited them for club nights. The real DJs played, and then we shot within the club. Michael Winterbottom and his cameraman were just running through the crowd shooting. But I remember sitting on the stage as they were all coming in and just seeing the looks on their faces. They went from an outside of this grotty old kind of warehouse, and then they came in, and the inside was the club, exactly how it was on the day it opened. And literally their faces were just, it was joyous to see that people kind of just like, oh my God, we're back, you know? And so that kind of fooling people, but not in real life, but also on screen, is something that's really enjoyable part of the production design process. I mean, often there's things, you know, where you're in some grotty studio, you know, in the West of London, and then you walk into the dark, and then you walk into, you know, an operating theater or a, you know, a church or something else inside, and it always makes people go whoa, you know. And I love that. That's a nice part of the job.
Well, as a film fan, a TV fan, I honestly have 20,000 questions, because one of my most most attractive bits to me as a consumer is, like, again, getting to see the sets. But I'm also very, one of my favorite stories is I was a big fan of, you remember the TV show House MD with Hugh Laurie?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I was watching special features on the DVD a number of years ago, and they talked about how their production schedule and their production team creates the sets. And they showed specifically this one basement set. And I thought for sure that they found that. They went to some place in New Jersey, and to hear them say, we designed it on a Monday, we built it on a Tuesday, they were acting on it on a Wednesday. And I couldn't comprehend, not the schedule, but like the ambition, the tradespeople to come together. And again, like you're saying, I'm fooled into thinking that this is real when it's completely fabricated. I'm in awe.
Yeah, it is incredible. And especially the studio-based system in the States as well, which we used to have here in a bigger way, but is now, it was kind of asset-stripped in the 1980s when people were after land and stuff. But we had similar big studios. MGM had a big studio that disappeared. But, you know, in LA, you have the big studios and you have all those crafts on site. So you have plaster shops. And we do have that at Pinewood and Shepperton in the UK. But I'm amazed by it myself still. I watched, I mean, probably about 10 years ago, was it, when Ugly Betty was on the screens. And I was amazed because they shot none of that in New York. And it was all set in New York. And I remember seeing a reel where she comes out of her house, and that was on the back lot, and they effectively CGI'd the other side of the street and a metro elevated train going across the back, you know. And there was one set they did where it was completely green, where she ran out of a building and bumped into a bus stop, and everything was green and it was all put in. So I mean, it's still, that still amazes me sometimes. And I think back in the day, they used to have that again at the BBC as well. They would have a different show every week, and in the studios, it would be a different show every day. And they'd take the sets down, and then they'd bring in the next one overnight and put it up. And they had two teams working, a day and a night team. I mean, I know that because my father-in-law used to work at the TV studios. And it's just an incredible system, and so believable. I mean, it's probably, I think sets now have got much more detailed because of the, you know, the advent of digital cameras and that kind of thing, which gives so much detail. They're almost like film. But before, you know, TV video was much more forgiving, and even film is much more forgiving than digital film. But they've got so detailed and so much. But when you look back, you'd think, well, they were doing huge amounts in the studio. And also the idea of shooting in black and white, they would have to paint like really bright colors next to each other to get the right contrast for black and white, which is an even process that you don't even think of. You just think, okay, well, they were normal color sets and then they filmed them in black and white. No, they would paint a purple wall next to a red wall to make the difference in black, you know, all this kind of, and it, the technique below it is just incredible, even to me. And I've been in the business, you know, nearly 30 years now.
Well, I don't want to get you kicked out of that magic circle, but I'm just curious. I've come to find this over watching many many special features and behind the scenes. It's like the crew and the stagehands have incredible control over the set when they build the set themselves, and usually that means no ceiling. So is like a kind of a rule of thumb that if you don't see the ceiling in a shot, it's most likely a set because there's really, you know, there's lights and rigging and stuff like that.
No, not necessarily. We build ceilings in some of our sets.
Okay.
Some of them are solid, and some of them have very clever ways of incorporating lighting. So one of the things we did in Ted Lasso, I did on my own, actually, because we didn't have the DOP by that stage, but I made a decision to include all the lighting in the set. So it was actually a real ceiling with real lighting in, and that lit the set so that we wouldn't have so much floor lighting and or ceiling lighting, and the cameras could just wheel around freely and look up and down. But also some sets don't have ceilings so that you can set lights, but some have what we call windbags in the UK, which are like flats with cloth on. And when you put them on the top, they look like a ceiling, but they're very easy just to whip off. And so if you've got a wide shot or a low shot where you see the ceiling, you can have them in. And then when you go for your close up, you could always take them off and have lighting from above. So there are many tricks of the trade that you can use to allow them or not have them. It just depends in what style your DOP is lighting it, whether he's lighting it more like natural light from the windows or using practicals. But there's so many options. It's quite amazing. I mean, sound always prefer it if you have a ceiling or some kind of ceiling, because obviously if it's an open space, it's not the same sound quality as if you're in a room with a ceiling. So there's lots of things to think about for other departments involved in our trade. And that's part of the technicality of the job.
Well, we'll look at that. Your 30 plus years in the business trumps my 30 years as a film fan. So you're going to win every time. Well, let's talk about your responsibilities, because, you know, a set is a controlled thing. A stadium is a living environment. So how do you work with the story, the writers, the directors to blend things and, you know, work with specific camera moves? I assume every project's different, but is there like a general workflow that helps inform your design decisions?
Jobs are very different, but they all work in the same way effectively. It just depends what kind of animal the job is. There are different animals in the kind of the world of the filmmaker. Generally, I'm one of the first people on because basically I'm responsible for everything that's in every shot that isn't the actors. So that's huge responsibility. So sets, locations, graphics, cars, props, furniture, you know, anything that is not makeup and costume and the actors. So so I'm on at an early stage. I read the script a lot and work with the director. We will go out with a location manager and choose locations if it's a location-based show, or I will start designing sets if it's a set-based show, or, you know, a combination of those two things if it's both. So the process always starts like that, meeting the director and the producer, having a general discussion about what we're aiming at. I would do some kind of mood boards of what I feel is my take on the script and the elements within it. And then we will... It's quite a nice process, but often the first process is sat in a car or a minibus going around looking at locations, which gives me and the director time to just chat about the script and about influences and what you like, how you think you might do it. You know, will it be, will the cameras be very static or will they be moving? So there's all that kind of bonding process. And we often do that without the DOP, because there's a traditional reason why DOPs are paid more, so they're often on for less time. And so we tend to do a lot of our work before the DOPs get there. director of photography, just making that clear. But we would do that. But then when the DOP comes on, that's another person to bring in the conversation, and then the other departments come on as well. But that's the basic start of the process. And then it's a case of all of us sitting around and deciding which is best to build a set, whether we need to build a set, whether we can do it on location, whether it's night or day. Can we film it at night? Can we afford to film it at night? Night filming is quite expensive because obviously it needs a lot of lights, and whether that's better done in a studio where the control of the light, and also daytime can be difficult to control light in a particular location. Like if you're in an office block, you have a lot of windows, you can't control the light coming and going all day, especially in the UK. It's not like LA, where sometimes the light is the same all day. In the UK, we might have four seasons in one day. So it's a problem. But so there's all those kind of decisions that we have as a team. And slowly, you kind of funnel your way through to how the production is going to actually work. And you get down into details and you choose locations. And then you get into how it's going to be dressed and all that kind of stuff.
Well, you know that expression, you make a movie three times, you make it when you write it, you make it when you shoot it, you make it when you edit. Do you have different layers in American football, there's an audible, which means you kind of change it on the day. Do you have opportunities where something comes along and we looked good on paper, it looked good in the model shop, but now that we're here, we have to, you know, this isn't going to work, or it's a wider view angle. You know, talk to me about some of those difficulties.
That's a general, that's a kind of process that happens all the time. Because it's a collaborative process, you can try and put into your, you've got something in your head, the director's got something in their head, you know, the other people on the film have got a different view of the script, and you all try and kind of get on the same page. There's a saying in the UK, we're all singing off the same hymn sheet. You know, we're all singing the same words to the same tune, but you can't always do that because everybody's imagination is different. So, you know, you all have different opinions about whether you can shoot at this location or in this set. And I've built sets where people come in on the day of shoot and say, well, I don't like this, you know, or I can't do this. And then you go, okay. So you have to be very pragmatic and be able to accept criticism and change things if you need to. I think it's very difficult when you're a designer and you're, you know, this is the only thing that I can do. I only see it this way, because it's a collaborative process. So you have to fit in with a director's, you know, view, a producer's view, how people are going to shoot it in a practical way. Also actors, you know, you might get actors who say, you know, I can't work in this. I need to feel, you know, this and that. So I think you have to be not precious about your work in some ways. You have to be quite confident as well to get your ideas across, because other people will kind of knock you off course otherwise. So it's a real balancing act to get that right. But I think sometimes happy accidents are some of the nicest things that happen. You know, you end up shooting in a location because on the day you couldn't get into that one or something, and you say, well, let's just shoot it around the corner, we'll shoot it here. But and actually some of those are some of the nicest things you do, because it's suddenly, you know, and the actors have to suddenly do a bit of improv to, you know, change the scene, and it's not in the script. Well, this isn't, it says it's a coffee shop, we're drinking by the side of the river, you know, it's like just go with it, you know. And then so often something nice comes out of that as well. So it's an ongoing process, and it has to be, the whole thing is organic. And what I always say to people is, you know, every film, every TV show is a prototype. I mean, they're all made in the same way, but we're creating, you know, absolutely something new. And so you have experience and you kind of know how most things are going to go, but it's always surprising, and you never know whether something's going to work, really. And also you never know whether audiences are going to like it. And that's the genius of the film business, in that it's not a business really. It's like punting at a horse race. You know, if the studios knew what people liked, they'd make even more money. But people you know, the audience, we're all fickle. We don't know what we like until we see it. And if we like it, we like it. And sometimes the things everybody thinks, my God, they're going to love this, they hate, you know, and that's wonderful in a way to me, you know, because it means it keeps evolving and it keeps being fresh. And then, you know, somebody completely new comes in and does something and everybody goes, oh, why don't we do that? You know, it's wonderful in that way, I think.
Well, I've been a fan of Arthur Max pretty much my entire life. I'm wondering what heroes you have, and also when you're working on things, you mentioned earlier about the advent of digital filming, and you know, I think we can go a little further to say that people are now being able to see and rewatch things that maybe the studios or networks thought people would never go back to, so they could get away with, you know, a like for like situation, or, you know, reusing this as that. Like, I think James Cameron, his Aliens was used as the Axis chemical scene in Tim Burton's Batman. It was just sort of repurposed. So, one, do you have heroes? And then two, what, I kind of forgot where I was going with the second one.
I do have heroes. Yeah. Obviously, there are some major designers who I've loved throughout the years, some of which I have a connection to. Obviously, Ken Adam is a big figure in the British production design world. He designed most of the big Bond movies, you know, Dr. No and all the ones with those huge sets. And he also designed Dr. Strangelove, which is one of my favorite films. I was lucky enough when I was at the Royal College of Art, I did an MA in film and television design at the Royal College of Art. And he was the person being honored with an honorary degree when we got our masters. So I managed to meet him. He's an amazing guy. He's a German, but he fought in the Battle of Britain on the British side. He was a Spitfire pilot, and then went into the film business and worked with everybody. Who else? I also I got nominated for an Emmy for Ted Lasso, and one of the other people who was nominated at the time was Beau Welch, who is a production designer who did like The Lost Boys and did so many films in the 80s. And I think he directed as well. I think he directed Cat in the Hat, maybe. But he was like, oh, wow, you know, I'm on the same Zoom call with Beau Welch. You know, that was like really, I wanted to ask him loads of stuff, but we kind of didn't have the opportunity. But and also Anton Furst, who designed the first Batman and was a very big kind of name in LA, but he was British and sadly committed suicide. But he also kind of brought on a lot of English designers like Nigel Phelps, who did the first Judge Dredd movie that I worked on as a very young assistant. I think he was Anton Furst's art director for a while. So he's a massive figure for me, I think. And also people like Geiger, who, you know, doing the Alien film. And but they're the kind of heroes, really. I can't remember the second part of your question either.
Yeah, my train went off the track. I think it was something about how you're able to, maybe the difficulties in not being able to reuse or repurpose things, because whether it's, you know, things maybe just
we reuse stuff all the time, and people
do tell.
Well, we do use, and especially now we're trying to be much greener, and we do try and reuse a lot of stuff. We do reuse flattage, and we reuse props all the time. So we hire props from prop houses in the UK. So you'll see the same sofa in like 40 or 50 different films and TV programs. So, you know, it's amazing. Yes, you're right. People can stop things and look at them now, not just like in the cinema and it's gone past and you'll never see it unless you go to the cinema again. But, you know, you can, like when we were kids and video, you'd stop things. So I remember watching Commando, the Arnold Schwarzenegger film, because we were amazed that when people were blown over hedges by grenades, you could see the flip boards coming up and they were flipping off them. And they didn't even bother to hide them. But when you watch the film the first time, you never saw them. But if you watch them 50 times on video, like we all did, you started to see these things. But I know you can still do that, but it's still amazing that people really don't notice that, you know, like the backlots in LA. I mean, I recognize backlots all the time in movies and TV programs. And it doesn't seem to, nobody seems to worry about that. And I think that's a lovely thing that my context is, if I start noticing the locations and I notice backlots and stuff like, or props and whatever I've seen somewhere else, I know I'm not in the film. And I probably know it's not quite as good as film as I would like. If I don't notice any of that and I get to the end of the film and say, that's brilliant, you know I was truly in the story, even for a designer, you know. And I suppose it's a little bit like being a magician. And if you can see how the trick is done, you can see it. But if you don't, and you get to the end, you think, wow, that's a really good trick because I couldn't see how they did it. So I think it's that. I think you'll find a lot of stuff does get reused and we just don't notice. Well, and I think that's good for the environment. You know, we should reuse sets, and we should. It's also getting harder and harder to film in cities. So backlots are becoming, you know, really important again, because crews are getting bigger and bigger at the moment. And it's just difficult moving around a modern city where there's a lot of traffic, both in LA and London. So I think those things are great that you can reuse and repurpose.
Well, yeah, actually, I probably should have probably shouldn't have asked that, just because I know for a fact I went on a studio tour at Paramount Pictures. I went on a studio tour at Warner Brothers, and I stood on the bridge that they used in The Last Samurai, and the way they dressed it up and changed the angles, you couldn't recognize it. And they talked about industry terms like bush carts and, you know, wigwags on the studio doors, these things. So I'm like, all these things that I love. I'm not saying the geekiness, and it's not an insult, but like these things that make your industry unique.
Yeah, no, they're great.
And just and how you weave magic. So I love it.
But we love those kind of things as well. We love those tricks where you do something and nobody notices. You know, it for us, that kind of thing is like, you know, it's like camera guys talking about cranes and, you know, all this kind of movie, you know, and cameras and stuff. But for us, it's those little trickery things. And also I think it's lovely that you go to Warner or you go to Paramount and there's a plaque on the studio door and it says what's been filmed there before. I mean, that geeks me out completely, you know. And I was actually there, you know, I did a bit of Ted Lasso in America last year, so they gave me an office at Warner Brothers, and I was like, you give me an office, like, oh my god, this is amazing. And and I even went around and sat on the friend's sofa in by the fountain, you know. I mean, we're all like that. I mean, you know, even Jason would have done that. You know, it's like everybody is, you, when you find out, you know, you've shot in a stage and Alfred Hitchcock has shot there, it's like, wow, that's amazing, you know. And I think it's the same in the UK. Whenever I go, if I go and work at Pinewood it or Shepperton, it takes me back to, you know, stuff that's been done there. I think that's wonderful.
Well, I'm enjoying this conversation so much, and one of the biggest things I wanted to talk to you about is Ted Lasso. So, from a very basic structure, is a TV show different from a film? How do you approach them? How do they share similarities? You know, what is Paul Cripps' take on being tasked with them?
Essentially, for me, it's the same job. It's the same basic job. But I think there's differences in that in a film, you've got 2 hours to tell a story. And I think the accent is on telling the story and getting everything right in that 2 hours. The thing about something like Ted Lasso is the characters grow and you also have more time to kind of understand those characters, and the audience does as well. So you do the same background when you initially start. You do the same background for a character, say, as you would do it for a film. So you kind of discuss, well, where's this character come from? What are they like? What style would they have in their house? What are the pieces of furniture they would have? But on a thing like Ted, it's allowed to grow a bit. And also the actors are in those characters for a long time, you know, like 3 years. So they actually get really immersed in those characters, and they'll come and talk to you and say, do you think they'd have this? I kind of feel that, you know, and that can be lovely, can also be annoying as well, if you know, but it is a process. And I think there's a kind of, you kind of get to explore a world a bit more and deeper. And And the other wonderful thing about Ted Lasso is they made connections. We would redo things, you know, and Jason had this thing about repeating things. So things that happened in season one, we would do something about it or repeat it with a different character in season two or season three. And I really liked that, you know, or take elements. And so it is a kind of different kind of thing, a TV show, especially one that goes on for a couple of seasons. I used to have a rule that I would only do the season one of a show. It was kind of a young designer's thing where I always wanted to seem like I was on the cutting edge of doing something new. I've kind of gone away from that because I think if you love a show, it's quite nice to stick with it, especially as Ted. I kind of knew it was three seasons because Jason had always kind of said that from the start and nobody believed him, but I kind of did. And so you knew there was, I kind of knew there was an end point and I wanted to be a part of that until the end. I don't think I would have wanted to do it if it had been like the US Office and done, you know, 15 seasons. But we have a thing in the UK where sometimes, like The Office, the UK Office and Fawlty Towers, where it's a limited run, and that's what's lovely about it in a way.
I've always loved that too, you know, Luther, yeah. In-betweeners, Black Books, they're, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's more pointed that way as opposed to, you know, a House, like I mentioned, 22, 25 episodes a season. It's like, it's not that it's not enjoyable, but I could see it's just, maybe there's some benefit to the brevity of it, you know?
Yeah, I think it's linked to the kind of US system where you have writer's rooms, and we didn't really have writer's rooms in the UK. It's usually written by one or two people, and they would get tired of writing, and they couldn't write that many a season. So we would have a season of, you know, maybe six or 10 or, but also they probably didn't want to go on writing that. Whilst if you've got writing rooms, you're always inviting new people and it brings a freshness to it, which I think I think a lot of British programs that went on got a bit stale because it was the same writers maybe, and they needed a refresh. And we didn't have the tradition of writer's room. It's taking off more and more here. But I think that's a reason. But I think the other lovely thing about Ted Lasso is that I think, like me, like you, Jason was a kid of television and film. He has such a kind of forensic memory of TV and film. And what I was quite lucky about was I watched a lot of American television as well as British television, and not a lot, you know, people watch some American television here, but not so much back then. But I used to watch things like Soap and WKRP, you know, and Hill Street Blues and all these kind of shows I used to love. And I got a lot. Jason writes a lot of kind of cultural TV reference into his scripts, and I was able to get those. And I think that's one of the reasons he liked having me as a production designer, because if he wrote something, I knew what he was talking about and he didn't have to explain it. You know, if he made a reference, I mean, some of them I didn't get because some of them were niche American ones and I didn't get those. But generally, I knew the TV culture ones or the film culture ones. And that was a nice thing because I'd watched those programs as a kid, you know, Cheers and all those kind of things rigidly, you know. So I think that was a nice thing to do because it kind of tapped into what I loved about TV as well. And why I love those kind of shows. I mean, Hill Street Blues is still one of my favorite shows. I love that show. We didn't do that many references to it, but there were a couple. But yeah, I think that, and that's the reason I work like working with Jason. You know, I kind of felt he'd come from the same thing where he again had been a kid who'd probably been told to go out and play more outside. But it was a great experience.
Well, the experience is definitely, as I said before, they come through the screen. There's things that fans gravitate towards. There are two. There's memes. There's so much to love. I think that you, even though the plan was to end in three seasons, you broke our hearts, but you were soft and gentle as you said goodbye to these characters. And so you look at a set. You know, your fantastic work in in the boss's office, which is a set. The locker room, which is a set. So walls are something. Walls are just walls until you put stuff in it. You've got characters. You've got props. Can we focus on maybe what is the smallest prop? The biscuit box. What went into the biscuit box? How much control? You know, were they edible biscuits? Give us the inside baseball.
The biscuits, right. So the biscuits, the reason they ended up in the pink box was because Jason wanted the audience to feel that he bought biscuits for the boss. And he was, you know, being a bit, it was a bit too nice, you know, it's a kind of, but he'd gone out and bought biscuits. And then he wanted the reveal that he was making the biscuits every night, which is hilarious. So that's why they were more like in a kind of gift box, as if they'd come from a bakery. So that's hence the pink boxes. They were edible, but not according to Hannah. In many interviews, she said they weren't edible in series one, which is a bit strange because we did actually get a home economist, what we call a home economist, who is somebody who makes food for set to make them. But she said they weren't very nice. So we did actually change the recipe and change them. And I think they got better. But then, you know, it's not great to come in at 8 o'clock in the morning and you're having to stuff biscuits. I mean, she's very good at eating them. She's great at eating acting. She's quite Brad Pitt in that respect. But yeah, I mean, they're shortbread. So they're kind of a classic, well, it's actually a Scottish biscuit. So they have a very English feel to them as well. I think there was a discussion about what the biscuit should be, but I think we also decided that those were probably the easiest for Ted to have made. But it was a nice, even, you know, nobody said that, but there was a reveal when we read the script and he was making them, which was nice for us as well. I can't remember. Is it in episode one where we see him making them? I think it is, isn't it? It's the end of it one.
Yeah, the very end where he's pulling that up.
But it's a nice book ending of the first episode in a way, in that you realize this guy's come from nowhere, but he's still managed to bake some biscuits for his new boss, which is kind of going beyond, above and beyond, really, isn't it?
Sure. And I guess maybe it's just his polite nature, because once you start something, that's the expectation and it takes it through the show. I love you mentioned they changed the recipe. I love that point in the series where he goes, I might have mixed up the salt and the sugar last night.
She goes, interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know if that came out of improv because they weren't very good, but maybe. Yeah, we changed a few things for Hannah, actually, because she's very tall like me, and we both, she was like, we had a different sofa in the second series. We hired one in the first series, but then we couldn't get the same one. So we basically bought one on eBay, and then we had it recovered in the beautiful kind of gold stuff, but it was quite low. And even I felt it was a bit low sitting down. She was, oh god, this is so we actually made it higher. So we do often have to change things in terms of trying to get things right as they go along and changing stuff. A lot of the time you don't notice. There is actually an extra window in her office in series one that is not there in series two, and nobody mentions it. That's what I say about things people not mentioning. I did a series called Merlin, and we used to shoot the exterior scenes at the castle in France and then exterior scenes in the woods in Wales. And the prince would ride out on one horse from the castle, and then he'd come into the woods in a completely different coloured horse, and nobody ever noticed. And my producer used to say, Paul, the horse could have a beard in one shirt and not in the other, and no one would notice. You know, because
that's the strength of the story. No one knows.
Yeah, well, they were looking at him as well. He was a good looking chap. You know, why would you look at the horse? But yeah, so things change from season to season. Hopefully people don't notice. And actually, even if people do, they're probably the people who are really geeking out on it. And it's probably a nice thing for them to spot. So, you know, yeah, but there's also a lot of things where we do get them wrong. You know, we provide the wrong thing on the day, and, you know, and Jason is always quite funny about that, because he's some things he's really kind of pedantic about, and other things we'll get it wrong and he'll make a joke about it and know whether he's really angry inside or he's just making a joke about it. But it is quite funny. He always wanted Ted and Beard to share a room when they went out on tour, which the footballers tend to. In a football team, in a UK football team, if you go away to an away match, you often have a roommate. But I just couldn't see somebody like Jose Mourinho sharing a room with his assistant. But Jason would always want them to be sharing a room, but it never quite worked out. And I got it wrong in series three as well. And we were rehearsing in there and I was in there and he said at the end of the rehearsal, "Do you know, when I watch this show in 30 years time and I see the scene, I'm just going to think twin beds." I was like, "Oh, okay."
Well, was it the first season when Beard and Lasso were next to each other and they go, "Howdy, neighbor." Was it 51-50?
Exactly. But yeah. I think he always intended them to be in the, you know, to be bunk mates. So
yeah,
that joke
yeah.
worked. But, you know, I think that was a nice thing. He obviously worked around it because, you know, couldn't quite say it. But we always had people sharing in terms of the footballers.
Well, I get that in order to do job, you either have to buy, build, or borrow something. But what about when you can't? I'm curious about Sam Obisanya's restaurant. I'm assuming that's a exterior shot and an interior set. And what about the sewers where Jamie Tart famously says, "That's just poop."
Yeah. Sam's restaurant in season two is a real restaurant. So we had a scene written in a restaurant with Edwin Akufu, the mad kind of African billionaire, where he hired out the whole restaurant with extras. So we were shooting the museum scene. We wanted to get the Tate Museum, the Tate Art Gallery. We wanted to shoot the Turbine Hall with you know, the art, who was a real artist from Nigeria. I think we managed to find a really great guy who would lend us his paintings for the art exhibit that Edwin takes Sam to. But the Tate Gallery, in their wisdom, they've had a few issues with Banksy, because he used to come and stick his work in the Tate without them knowing about it. And we had a joke about Banksy in the scene, and they wouldn't let us film in the Tate if we kept the joke in about Banksy. So we ended up filming at the Natural History Museum and changing it into an art museum. So we covered the art exhibit, the dinosaur fossil exhibits, with paintings, partly digitally. And we needed a restaurant for the second half of that day. So we chose a Polish restaurant in South Kensington in London. And then in the last episode, the script arrived and it said that Sam bought the restaurant. We're like, "Oh, okay. We're going to need that restaurant in series three then." And they're like, "Yeah, maybe, yeah." And so when we got series three,
a lot of nice shots, right?
Yeah. So we've closed quite a few restaurants. Obviously, we have a Taste of Athens, which was a Mediterranean restaurant in Notting Hill, which we kept closing down. They were kind of all right with it. But obviously, because series two was kind of COVID, and there was still a bit of COVID going on when we started three, it was quite difficult to get restaurants to agree to filming, and because they'd been closed for so long, they didn't want to close for us. And anyway, so in the end, we decided to build Sam's restaurant. So I completely matched the restaurant as an interior set. And then outside, we had a kind of photorealistic backdrop. And then we shot looking at the restaurant, we shot on our set in the studio. And then we digitally placed our restaurant from the studio into the real street. Which is kind of crazy, I know, but that's the kind of crazy thing we do sometimes. And it worked really well. I'm sure it was a headache for the post people, for Kip and his post people, but they're all so good at it. You know, I don't worry about it too much. But it worked really well, but we did build that. But it was a direct match, but perhaps a bit bigger kitchen-wise and a bit different at the back. But it was pretty matching to the restaurant that we used in South Kensington. What was the other part of the question? I remember.
Oh, the sewer. I mean, it was a very small
sewer. Yes,
like 2 minutes or 3 minutes.
Yeah, so we investigated real sewers. It's very difficult to get anything down into the sewers in London, health and safety wise. So in the end, what we did, I decided that we should shoot in railway arches near Brick Lane, which is kind of famous kind of part of London that a lot of tourists do actually go to. But there are some big railway arches there. And so we built some platforms as if they were sewers. And then we also had a kind of special effects tank with water in it so we could get reflections and use of lighting and then a bit of feel of water. And then they CGI'd the full kind of sewer in, and they made the tunnels go further back and go around a corner. So it was a partial location and set build with a kind of CGI extension. And everybody was a bit like, really, is this going to work? And I was like, yeah, it's going to be like The Third Man. So The Third Man, the scene in the kind of sewers where he chases Harry Lime, this is what it's going to be like. This is this. And they were like, you sure? Yeah, it's like, no, I can see it. And actually, the VFX supervisor, James, in the UK, who's great, and Kip and all the guys in post were like, oh yeah, I kind of see how I can. They were all into it, so it was me and them, you know, and everybody else going, are you sure about this? You know, it's like, no, it'll work. And then we had to do getting down into the sewer, and we so we wanted to pick a place. I wanted to kind of pick a place that was recognizably Richmond, so we had to fake them going down. So I also had to build. So we shot them what looked like they were going down in the street, but then we had to build a piece of sewer to actually get them up and down as well. So it was quite an involved bit, but it worked really well, I thought. It was kind of crazy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all cobbled together to tell a story. So, you know, where one thing ends, you seam it together with the other. I mean, you could have done it 15 different ways, I'm sure. You know, consumers like myself bought it.
It's a lot of the way we work. You have to do, you know, this scene is in London. They go through a corridor in a set somewhere else, and then they come out and they're in Scotland. I don't know. But it's kind of like a mental journey. If you can see it in your mind happening and you can paste those things together, it's amazing what you can do with editing. And as long as you kind of keep, as long as the weather's the same in the same locations and you seamlessly do it via something like something passes or whatever, you do get away with it. And it's about building journeys. So I remember we did a series once where it was supposed to be in Brighton, but we shot some of the scenes in London. But I built a mental map of the journey. So you went down one street in London, turn left, then you went there, and then you ended up at the sea. And if you always did that kind of journey in the same way, people would believe that this place was right by the sea. So I think it's about mentally mapping stuff out in your head. And if it works in your head, or if it works in my strange mapping head, then it kind of works on the screen as well. I think as long as people are with you in making the journey, you can get away with a lot of different places shooting, but it ends up as one journey. I mean, Ridley Scott is a master of that. If you watch The Duelists and you listen to the commentary, the commentary he does for The Duelists, he does this scene where he goes, watch this scene. It's great. They ride up. The sun is behind them. You cut to the reverse. The sun's behind them on that one. There's two suns. And he said, the pots are on that side in this shot. And then we moved them over here and it's a completely different place. You know, he's just so good at working with such a limited palette, but can make it so good. And he breaks rules. You know, he's got two sons in that scene, but nobody notices.
Well, I'm in Dallas, Texas, and we have one of our famous buildings in the skyline. It's called Reunion Tower. It's part of a hotel, has a globe at the top, the restaurant spins. Paul Verhoeven, when he was shooting RoboCop, had to do this kind of the same thing. There's a freeway chase and you see the globe here. further down the street, the Globe. So it's like you have to do what you have to do, and most people won't notice. But
no, yeah. they won't. And those people who do, it's a nice thing for them to go, did you see in that?
Did you what? This is probably a very dumb question, but how important is scale to you? I know that usually when you shoot TV, you try to work with forced perspective, or you have miniatures in the back, but how important is the sense of space? And I ask that because this is what I do for a hobby. My actual career is I'm an interior designer. So I have a interior architecture background and license. And when I'm drawing rooms and hotels and things, it seems big on plan. And then you get to the set, or you get to the site, and they frame the walls and it feels small. But then somehow once the finishes are applied and the fixtures start coming in, it starts to have the sense of scale is appropriate. So do you have to overscale things? You know, how is it working with cameras? And I know that's a very big question, but does any of that make any sense?
Yeah, no, it does. Absolutely. It's something I teach. Actually, I taught for a couple of years at my old college, which is the University of Arts London. And I teach. And one of the most important lectures I thought I used to do is about depth and light in filmmaking, because depth is absolutely important, like almost number one importance in terms of shot creation and creating amazing shots. It's about depth and creating depth in the frame, because basically it's a weird thing that your mind does, because you're looking at a 2D image, but it's a 3D thing. Your brain converts it into a 3D image. And there's something quite fascinating about that. But I think the more you can create depth in a shot, the better a shot is. And it doesn't matter how you do it. There's a number of ways of doing it. You can do it with perspective. So you can have lights disappearing into the distance. You can have it with frames within frames are really good. So if you've got a room, it's great to have, even if you can't have too big a room, maybe divide it up and have another smaller room before and have a doorway, because it feels like there's more space and it feels more real, rather than just having one wall, you know, a room with four walls and a window. Why not have a little anteroom? You don't know what's in there, but it just creates that feeling that it's a real building. And anywhere you can have depth down the lens just makes for such a good shot, you know. So space and depth and how the light enters that is like fundamental to the design, really. And that's something I'm always trying to think about when I'm designing a set, is how the light enters it. And whenever I'm out and about in the world, or in other people's houses, or in buildings in London or elsewhere, I just take photos of when I see light coming into windows, or how things affected, or even if it's a practical light and what's that doing, you know, how is that practical light? Or if there's a neon sign, how is that lighting that street? Because it's all about layers and depth, really, for me. And I think that's so important. I think you're right. I think finishes, and I mean, the Greeks and the Romans knew about this, about all the elements of style, you know, how columns work, they're proportional, and, you know, things like the golden section that allow things to be proportional. It's really important. And if you can learn all that, I mean, I learned all that on my course, because when we did theatre design, we did like a history of art, although they don't really teach history of art anymore. But we learned about the fundamentals of architecture, you know, and about the different heights of ceilings and rules for that. And that's really interesting. And I don't think people look at that enough in terms of, I think the really great designers do look at that in terms of depth. And when you look at Ken Adams' set, like the war room for Dr. Strangelove, it's all about how the light comes into that room. And that room is not that big, but it's the way it's lit and the way it's filmed. It just looks massive, you know, and you can add space. And then practically, you were saying practically, we do often have to build things a little bit bigger than normal for camera, because obviously you've got a crew in there and you've got a camera moving around. Case in point is the houseboat that we built for episode 6 for series 3 of Ted Lasso. And we had an exterior of a real houseboat in Amsterdam, and then we built a set in London for the interior. And I was trying to keep it as small as possible so it didn't seem ridiculously big. So it's not like we always say in the UK, so it's not like single white female, you know, like young woman living in a Manhattan apartment that costs $3.5 million. But you know, so it doesn't feel ridiculously huge. But we did have to build, I built it wider and allowed for parts that came off so you could shoot with the camera outside the set, but still feel like you were inside. So the lens is just inside the wall. So there's that. You can build with flats, so you'll still feel like you're in the room, but you're allowing the space of the camera and the camera team to be outside the set. But yeah, we often build a little bit bigger. But if you can keep the proportions the same, it's about working out the ratio of the height and the width and the height, then it often feels right. Because when you're in a room with a camera and you're in a normal location, it often looks bigger anyway, even if it's a tiny space. And it's to do with lens choice in that regard as well. But yeah, it is difficult. You don't want to make it seem too big. Well, it depends what it is, you know, big sets, you know, big kind of civic buildings or whatever. You can make those as big as you like, really, and the bigger the better, in a way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, whether it's Peter Lamont doing some Bond movie or Rick Heinrichs doing a Tim Burton movie, you know, with you're expected to have those sense of scale. And I get how that, you know, it's suited to the need of the story. But if I can ask something personally to you, you're being responsible for art direction and set design and production design. What if you could dial it down to one thing? What gives you the most satisfaction? Is it completing a design? Is it having it built? Is it having a prop in your office at the end of the shoot? Is there one thing that you consistently, you know, makes you get up in the morning and say, yes, I'm in the right business?
I think there's lots of satisfaction. I think it's satisfaction can be when you know, they first come to film on a set, the crew and the actors, and they're like, oh, wow, this is amazing. You know, and if you get that response, that is such a great feeling. And, you know, they're happy with it, you know, and often when they start filming, they're like, yeah, it's really great. But, you know, can we saw down this wall? It's like, well, okay. But that initial thing of people walking in and going, oh, my God, this is amazing, you know, and it doesn't always happen. And it's great when it does. But also, I think when people, I mean, one of the loveliest things about Ted Lasso has been the fans' response to the sets and the locations and how much people have taken those things to heart. And it's almost like you've created something a little bit iconic, like the Cheers bar or whatever. That's wonderful. And I live near Richmond and I walk through over weekend and I see people doing a Ted Lasso tour and they're outside the pub and they're taking photos. I mean, that's just lovely. And I walk through and they don't know that I'm anything to do with it. And I just hear them talking about, oh, look, there's the Crown and Anchor. And that's wonderful to me because people have traveled across the world to come and see a location that I picked and, you know, and I changed. But the people know it and recognize it is something that's wonderful to me. And also the response in terms of Ted Lasso in that it's helped people through difficult times in their life, and they've emailed me and they've emailed the cast about that, and that is such an emotional thing that you're not just working on something that's a bit of fluff or a bit of, you know, throwaway entertainment. It's actually meant something to somebody, and that's kind of really important, and that makes you feel good.
Well, the story and the characters warm my heart, the jokes warm my belly. Your set design, all your fabulous work is like a milkshake for my eyes. I've enjoyed this immensely, so much so that I feel like I'm in cahoots with Puss in Boots, playing lutes for prostitutes while reading Roots. Mr. Cripps, it has been a pleasure. Thank you. To send us out on an even higher note, what's next for you? What can we look forward to? Or are you getting a much-deserved break for a little bit?
Well, I have just finished a different show. So I've been working on the second series of a series called SAS Rogue Heroes, which is a kind of World War II film. Well, it's a drama series about the formation of the SAS, our kind of UK Special Forces that happened during World War II. There's Series 1, which I didn't design, but it's very good, designed by a great designer called Richard Bullock. And it's, I think it's on Epics in the US. Really worth watching. Great characters and an amazing story that you just don't believe, but it is 90% true. So I've been doing the second series of that, which has been amazing. I finished that in September. We were lucky we weren't affected by the SAG strike because we were working under a different union. And since then, I've been off. And I am supposed to go to the Emmys in January, but it looks like I won't be able to go because I'm having a major knee operation, which I've needed for a long time, which is a shame, but it's something I need to do. And now that means I probably won't be working till March, but I'm excited to find out what I might be working on next. And I don't know. That's the beauty of being a freelancer.
Well, I wish you the very best, and I will check out SAS. And if Ricky Gervais has taught me anything, SAS does not stand for Super Army Soldier. Thank you for your time, Mr. Cripps, and we will talk
Thank you very much.
Soon.
Thank you. It's been enjoyable. But we will meet again. I know the art is tall, but we could be so much.